Flashing, what does that mean?
There goes, okay.
Ready to go?
We're ready.
Okay. Okay, let's begin with a word of prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for giving us your word. We thank you for all of the many different narratives and the many different kinds of literature that are in your word to help us. We thank you for faithfully preserving it for us. We ask that you would help us today to learn the many lessons that are available to us in the book of Esther. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. This year, the Jewish Feast of Purim falls on March 1st, this next Thursday. So I thought this would be an appropriate time to review the book of Esther. In the latter part of the book of Esther, I won't have time to go through the entire book of Esther, but I will give you the introduction and background today, and hopefully I can encourage you to study this book, read this book, or reread it, as the case may be. In the latter part of the book of Esther, we learn about how Purim was instituted, and Mordecai, who is one of the main characters in the book. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar and also the 15th day of the same, year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies. Notice that it says the 14th and the 15th, and that is why most people celebrate Purim on the 14th day, but in walled cities, they celebrate Purim the next day. And that is why the people who are in Israel right now, from Gospel of Grace, will find that in Tel Aviv, for example, they celebrate Purim on one day, and in Jerusalem, which was a walled city, they celebrate on the next day. For Haman, he's the villain of the story of Esther, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur to crush and destroy them. Therefore, they called these days Purim after the term Pur. The command of Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing. So Purim is the plural of Pur. Well, what is a Pur? A Purim is simply a little clay cube with markings on it. It's very similar to our modern pair of dice, you know, that we use for gambling or for playing games. And Haman was going to use the Purim to determine on which day he was going to annihilate the Jews. And that is why this feast is called Purim. I want you to think about how peculiar that is. Why would you call a feast after the method your enemies were going to use to destroy you? I mean, that would be kind of like having an annual celebration of the D-Day invasion of the Allies in World War II, an annual celebration of the D-Day invasion, and you call it the Feast of Nazi Machine Guns.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make sense, does it?
Right.
But as Joseph said to his brothers in the book of Exodus, you planned evil, but God planned it for good. See, God can have a sense of humor about these things. He's not very impressed with the puny efforts of man to thwart his plans. As it says in Psalm 2, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. So God doesn't have any problem calling a feast day after the method that Haman had planned to use to destroy the Jews. The key verse in the book of Esther is the advice that Mordecai gave to his cousin Esther. If you keep silent at this time, liberation and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place. But you and your father's house will be destroyed. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. And this is something that we can all learn. That in whatever circumstances God has allowed each of us to be in, those circumstances will work for God's good, for God's glory, for the fulfillment of God's plan. Even when those circumstances seem to be so much less than ideal. As I said, today I'm going to give you the introduction and background to the book of Esther. Legacy is an acronym that I use when studying the background of a book of the Bible. Legacy stands for location. Where did the book take place? Where did it happen? Essence, what is the book about? Genre, that means the type of literature. There are many types of literature in the Bible. There is historical narrative. There is prophetic writing. There is poetry. In the New Testament, there are epistles. So there are different kinds of literature in the Bible, and it's very important to understand which type of literature we're looking at. A is for author, who wrote the book, who was under the influence of the Holy Spirit to write the book. C is for context, what other things are happening before, after, around the story that we're looking at. And years, when did the story take place? So let's look at each one of those things briefly. The story of Esther takes place in the royal city of Shushan, or Susa, in the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire had two capitals. They were seasonal. They had a summer capital and a winter capital. So the summer capital was at Persepolis, a city called Persepolis, and the winter capital was Susa, or Shushan. And the events of the story that we're looking at in the book of Esther take place in Shushan, the winter capital. In Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonian Empire, had a dream. And Daniel, under the direction of the Holy Spirit, explained to him what that dream meant. Nebuchadnezzar saw a huge image of a man, a metallic image, with head of gold, arms and chest of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, and legs of iron. And Daniel explained to him that each of these components of this image represented the sequence of Gentile empires that would rule over the land of Israel. So this image represented, the head of gold represented the Babylonian Empire. The arms and chest of silver represented the Medo-Persian Empire. The belly and thighs of bronze represented the Greco-Macedonian Empire. And the legs of iron represented the Roman Empire. So we're concerned in the story of Esther about the second part of the image, the arms and chest of silver, the Medo-Persian Empire. It was called the Medo-Persian Empire because it was a blend, a conglomeration of these two peoples, the Medes and the Persians. This carving into stone represents the Medes and the Persians. The men wearing with the rounded headgear, they're the Medes, and the ones with the fluted headgear, they're the Persians. So they integrated their two armies, their two peoples. At the time of Daniel, the Medes are mentioned first. Daniel always talked about the Medes and the Persians because they were then the dominant power of the two. By the time of Esther, the Persians had become the dominant power. So this entity came to be known as the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire was huge. As I mentioned, there were two capital cities. So first we see Babylon, which was the capital of the Babylonian Empire. And then we have Susa, the winter capital of the Persian Empire, and Persepolis, the summer capital. So, and if we back out a little bit, we can see just the full extent of the Persian Empire. It was larger in territory than the later Roman Empire. So it stretched all the way from the edge of Europe here and into Egypt and part of North Africa, the Asia Minor, then all the way into what are modern Israel and Jordan and Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan. And to the east, it goes all the way up into Central Asia. And here it goes into a little ways into India. So it's a very large empire with very diverse peoples of all kinds. I mentioned it was larger than the Roman Empire. Now, in terms of population, well, one of the things you have to consider is that between the time of the Persian Empire and the Roman Empire, world population had nearly doubled. So there were more people in the Roman Empire simply because the world was more populous at that time. But in terms of percentage of the world's population, the Persian Empire was actually larger, because think about this now. At the time of the Persian Empire, 44% of all the people on earth were in the Persian Empire, 44%. Whereas in the Roman Empire, it was like 35.9%. So it was a smaller percentage of the world's population. Some of you may know that I'm really into history and archaeology. And one of the things that really fascinates me about the Book of Esther is that we can know precisely where so many things happened. For example, with the Book of Ruth, we know that the main events in the Book of Ruth take place in the vicinity of Bethlehem. But we can't point to a pile of rubble and say, there, that's where Ruth and Naomi lived, and this is where the field of Boaz was located, and this was where the threshing floor was located. We simply don't know those specific details. We know it was in and around Bethlehem, but we don't know. With the case of Esther, however, archaeologists know exactly where the palace was, and most of the events in the Book of Esther take place in and around the palace complex. Now, this fortress that you see down here in the lower right corner, that is not an ancient structure. That was built to protect the French archaeologists who were excavating the site back in the 1800s. So security has long been a major concern for Westerners in the Middle East. It's quite a substantial fortress just to protect some archaeologists. But as I mentioned, archaeologists have not only found the site of the palace complex, they have even identified which rooms were used for which things. So many of the incidents that we read about in the Book of Esther, they know exactly which room it happened in and where those rooms were in the palace complex. So these numbers that you see are different places that the archaeologists have identified. And here's a listing of some of the locations in the Book of Esther. You see number two there. I don't know if you can read the small writing. But number two there is the Arpadna, the site of the large banquet. So this is the huge columned hall where the king of Persia had a banquet for his nobles and officials. So all of these, I mean, the king's gate, we know where that was. We know where the outer courtyard was. We know where the inner courtyard was. We know where the throne room was, where the king was sitting when Esther approached him, and he extended his scepter to her, preserving her life. She would have been killed if he had not extended his scepter. So there's a drawing of the palace complex and with those numbers once again. And here is an artist's reconstruction of what the palace may have looked like back in the time of Esther. And you see this, the columned hall here, where this is where that large banquet was held for the nobles and the officials. I mentioned that there are two capitals, Persepolis and Susa. Some of the pillars are still standing at the other capital in Persepolis. And I want you to see how big these pillars are. Here's an artist's reconstruction of them. And you see the pillars here. And see the people down here? See how small they are in comparison to the pillars? This hall was designed to create the impression that you were in a forest. So that's these huge pillars. Let's look at the essence of the Book of Esther. What is the book about? The Book of Esther is a very unusual book in the Bible. It's unique in that there is no mention of God in the Book of Esther. You won't find Yahweh, the Lord, anywhere in the Book of Esther. You won't find the Hebrew words for God, Elohim or El or Eloah, anywhere in the Book of Esther. And because of that reason, some, both Jews and Greeks, or both Jews and Christians, have been reluctant to consider the Book of Esther part of the inspired biblical canon, because there's no mention of God in it. And yet many of you have probably read the Book of Esther your entire life, and it's never occurred to you that God is not in the book, because you see the hand of God in every scene, working behind the scenes to bring about his plans and his purposes. So this is basically what the book is about. A genocidal plot by the king's advisor, Haman, he's the villain of the story, brings grave danger to the Jews, but is countered by the courage of a beautiful Jewish woman named Esther, providentially placed in the kingdom for such a time as this. Esther's courage, along with the wise counsel of her cousin Mordecai, resulted in deliverance for the Jewish people and demonstrated Yahweh's sovereign power over peoples and nations. And that is the main thing that we can learn from the Book of Esther, is that God is at work even when we don't see him, even when he's not mentioned. This is sort of a family tree of Esther and Mordecai. When the southern kingdom of Judah was taken into captivity by the Babylonians, it didn't happen all at once. There were three stages in that process. In 605 BC, Daniel and his friends were among those who were taken into captivity. In 597, Ezekiel and about 10,000 other people were taken into captivity. And then in 586 was the final time when the city of Jerusalem was destroyed. But the ancestor of Esther and Mordecai was taken in that second deporting in 597 with Ezekiel. And so these dates are approximate. The Bible doesn't give us the exact dates. But you can see that Mordecai and Esther were cousins, and Mordecai was about 15 years or so older than Esther. So when Esther's parents died, Mordecai took on the responsibility of being a father to her. It's also interesting to note that Esther and Mordecai were from the tribe of Benjamin. The significance of that is that the tribe of Benjamin had a couple of black marks on them. If you read the book of Judges, towards the end of the book of Judges, you will find that the tribe of Benjamin became involved in some very nasty things, and the other tribes of Israel almost wiped them out. And then the second black mark was that the first king of Israel, King Saul, was also from Benjamin, and his administration didn't turn out very good. So Benjamin had these two black marks against them. With Esther and Mordecai, that begins to turn around. Benjamin does something positive for Israel. And then that trend continues on in the New Testament because the Apostle Paul was from the tribe of Benjamin. Genre, the type of literature that we're looking at. We're looking at Hebrew historical narrative. In other words, a story is telling us what happened. And though the historical books of the Bible consist of accurate records of historical events and personalities, they, like all other ancient historical narratives, involved intentional selection and structure of the events recorded. One of the things that Bob and Eric have done for us is to teach us the importance of the chiastic structure in the scriptures. We've seen that many, many passages of the Bible are arranged in a chiastic structure. In some cases, entire books of the Bible are in a chiastic structure. And that is certainly true of the book of Esther. And so we see the words that are used to describe these various portions of the book of Esther. And everything leads to a turning point, a reversal. And then it begins to work its way out. You can see the word denouement. There's a little French lingo thrown in there for you. So the chiastic structure can either be arranged vertically like this, or it can be arranged horizontally like this. So you see the developments building towards this climax, towards this turning point, and then it begins to reverse itself, begins to work its way out. And the turning point of the story is very interesting because the turning point of the story comes one night when the king couldn't sleep. So that just shows you how God is able to work through events that seem to be inconsequential, insignificant. The king couldn't sleep. Apparently his sleep number was not appropriately adjusted. So I realize that this is too small for you to read on the screen, which is why I've given in addition to the handout, there's another handout which shows the structure of the book. And so there you can see the detailed analysis of the book. And you can see how symmetrical it is in the chiastic structure in which it is arranged. And you can see the turning point in the middle there with the night the king could not sleep. That's when he finally decides to check the records, and he discovers that Mordecai once saved his life and was not properly rewarded. So that's when Haman's evil plan begins to unravel. Bob has written in CIC about the concept of the mishta. It's a Hebrew word meaning banquet or feast. And it's not just a banquet for the sake of having a banquet. It's a banquet with consequences. As a result of the banquet, some are elevated and some are brought down. And whether you're elevated or brought down has to do with your relationship with God. This is a theme running through the Bible. We see it in the parables that Jesus told about a banquet or a wedding feast. We see it in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where the Apostle Paul is talking about the Lord's Supper, and some observe the Lord's Supper in a godly manner, and they receive the benefits, and others observe it in an ungodly manner, and they suffer the consequences. And then, of course, it goes all the way through to the end of the Bible, the book of Revelation. We read about the marriage supper of the Lamb. And we read about how some are dining, and some are dined upon by the birds of the heavens. Once again, there's that theme of the banquet that separates the godly from the ungodly. This theme of banqueting is very prominent in the book of Esther. The book begins with a banquet that the king of Persia has for his nobles and officials, and then he has another banquet for the common people. And then as a result of that, Queen Vashti is put down and Queen Esther is exalted. And then what does the king do? He has a banquet for her. And then later on, we see the banquets that Esther has for the king and for Haman. There's one before the turning point and one after the turning point. And as a result of these banquets, Haman is put down and Mordecai, her cousin, is elevated. There is archaeological evidence to confirm that the Persian kings were indeed party animals. These are some gold and silver plates and cups and bowls from the Persian kings. This golden bowl here is interesting because there is an engraving around the rim of the bowl that shows that this golden bowl was actually used by King Xerxes, who was the king in the story of the book of Esther. And this is a drinking vessel, a golden drinking vessel that was used by the ancient Persians. Now, the ancient Persians had what seemed to us some very bizarre ideas about drinking and making decisions. We recognize that decisions that you make while you're drunk are probably not going to be very good decisions. But the Persians got drunk in order to make decisions. Anytime that they were going to make an important decision, they got drunk. They felt that they made their best decisions while they were inebriated. So there was a lot of heavy drinking at these banquets that the kings of Persia had. Next, we'll look at the author of the book of Esther. While internal evidence makes clear that the author was Jewish and familiar with Persian customs, the author is no longer known. And that's the situation with many of the books of the Old Testament. Who wrote 1st and 2nd Kings? Who wrote 1st and 2nd Chronicles? We simply don't know who those individuals were, but we are certain that they were doing their writing under the inspiration of God. The book must have been written after the reign of Xerxes, obviously. He's the king during this time, and probably some considerable time thereafter. For references, I list the references there that would seem to imply that several generations at least had taken place before this book was written. So it happened shortly afterwards, but not immediately afterwards. The Josephus and I think one of the church fathers, Clement, they thought that Mordecai had written the book of Esther, but it seems unlikely that it was actually written by Mordecai. And as you read the book of Esther, there's no indication that Mordecai is the author of the book. The context of the book. Cyrus, the king of Persia, had defeated Babylon in 539 BC. It is now during this book of Esther in the early 5th century BC, and Xerxes is on the throne. The first return of the Babylonian captives by Zerubbabel has already occurred after the Persians conquered the Babylonians. Shortly after that, King Cyrus issued a decree that allowed the exiles to return to their homeland. Most Jews, however, remained in Persia. It's going to be several more decades before a second wave occurs under Ezra, followed by a third under Nehemiah. I mentioned before that there were three stages of going into captivity, and there are three stages in coming out. The events recorded in the book of Esther as well as Esther's reign in Persia, occurred during the decades between the first and second waves of return. This is the Cyrus cylinder. It's about it's a clay cylinder, but it's about 9 inches long and about 4 inches in diameter. But there's writing on the cylinder that indicates that Cyrus, the king of Persia, allowed the exiled peoples to return to their homeland, and it also allowed these exiled peoples to restore their places of worship. So it wasn't just the Jews who were allowed to return to their homelands and rebuild their places of worship, but certainly the Jews were included in that. So there is archaeological confirmation of that. It's not that we need archaeological confirmation to prove to us that the Bible is true and what is in the Bible, but it is good to have archaeological evidence when you're dealing with unbelievers, to show them that the Bible isn't just a collection of fairy tales. There is actual archaeological evidence to back this up. Bob?
There are people right now in Israel that from church. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about something because I see all these Mormons that are, you know, politicians. I wonder when they're going to do a tour of the places in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. Well, don't hold your breath, Bob. Yeah. That, maybe they're working on that, but they're going to have to work a long time. Yeah. So this is just a diagram of where the Book of Esther fits into the context of the events recorded in the Bible. So as I mentioned, there were three phases for the return of people. So this first phase was shortly after Cyrus became king and conquered the Babylonian Empire. And that was under Zerubbabel that people were allowed to return, and they began construction of the second temple. But the other phases didn't come till later. And Ahasuerus is the king here of Xerxes of the Book of Esther. So this is the period of time that we're looking at here in the Book of Esther. And then later, after the Book of Esther, comes the second and third, first under Ezra and then under Nehemiah. And this Artaxerxes is the son of Xerxes. And so you can see down here that the events recorded in the Book of Esther take place sort of in the middle of the Book of Ezra. So over here we have the early chapters of Ezra, and over here we have the later chapters of Ezra, where Ezra actually goes to the land of Israel. So that's when this takes place. And then later on in the Book of Nehemiah is that third phase of the return. So I mentioned before that the Book of Esther doesn't even mention God anywhere in the book. And because of that, some, both Jews and Christians, have been reluctant to accept Esther as part of the scriptural canon. Among the Dead Sea Scrolls, you will find every single book of the Old Testament with the exception of Esther. Esther is not included in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And for Christians, in the first 7 centuries of Christian church, there were no commentaries on the Book of Esther. Martin Luther did not like the Book of Esther at all. He put it in the same category as the apocryphal book of 2 Maccabees. So he didn't like the Book of Esther, and he said that he wished it had not been written. Well, I'm very thankful that it has been written for our benefit. Like I said, many of you have studied, read the Book of Esther for many years, and it's never occurred to you that God is not there, because you see the hand of God clearly at every turn. And finally, we look at the years in which this occurs. As far as the context, some of the other things that were happening in the world at that time, over in China, there was this philosopher named Confucius. Confucius is a westernized, Latinized version of the name. In China, he was actually known as Kung Fu Zi. And then over in the West, in Greece, this was the golden age of the Greeks, with Pericles. If you remember from your high school math, your geometry, the Pythagorean theorem, well, that's when Pythagoras was extant. The story occurs within a brief period during the reign of Xerxes in the first half of the 5th century B.C. The Book of Esther refers to the king who ruled at the time as Ahasuerus. That's a mouthful, isn't it? The Hebrew word is actually Achashverosh. So that's why I usually refer to him as Xerxes. It's a lot easier to say than either Ahasuerus or Achashverosh. But there was no Persian king by that name. So who was he? Who was this Achashverosh? The Jewish historian Josephus thought it was Artaxerxes, the son of Xerxes. But most scholars today think it was Xerxes. The events of Esther seem to fit better with the facts we know about Xerxes from history. Incidentally, just talking about the name of Ahasuerus or Achashverosh, it could be that one of the reasons that there's no king by that name is that this is just actually a nickname that the Jewish author of the Book of Esther is using, because Achashverosh doesn't really have a Hebrew meaning, but King Achashverosh sounds very similar to King Headache. So if you think that there's a possibility that the author of the Book of Esther is making fun of the Persian king, you're probably right. I mentioned that one of the reasons that I find the Book of Esther so fascinating is because there's so much archaeological evidence that you can look at in conjunction with the story. This is actually a carving of King Xerxes sitting on his throne, and the one standing directly behind him is his son, Artaxerxes. And you'll notice that in his hand he has a scepter. And you remember from the story of Esther how he extended his scepter to her, making it possible for her to approach him. There's a close-up of that portion of the carving where King Xerxes is seated upon his throne. The Greek historian Herodotus said that Xerxes was the tallest and the most handsome of the Persian kings. But he wasn't a very good decision maker. It seems that he wasn't able to make decisions on his own. Whoever had access to him kind of steered him in their direction. So even though he was the king of this vast, powerful empire, he didn't seem to have really much power. His advisors kind of ran the show. Now, this is once again showing us how the Book of Esther fits in. I just want to remind you how it fits in with the events that are taking place at the time, as recorded in the Bible, how it fits in with the other books of the Bible. And then down at the bottom, you see how the prophets, where it comes in with the prophets of the Bible, with Zechariah and Haggai and Malachi. And you can see how they relate to these events of Israel being restored to the land of Israel. No, so, well, let's go back here. And it'll be easier for you to see this. So once again, we have the fall of Jerusalem in 586 when Jerusalem was taken captive by the Babylonians. And then Persia conquered the Babylonian Empire in 539 BC. And shortly after that, King Cyrus issued this decree that the exiles could be restored to their homeland and they could restore the places of worship. And then in red, you see the things that we are concerned with in the Book of Esther, the reign of Xerxes in Persia from 486 to 465 BC. And then Esther's reign began sometime during that period, around 479 BC. And then the second return to Jerusalem under Ezra takes place later, and then the third return under Nehemiah. So this is just some of the events that took place during the reign of this King Xerxes. So Xerxes became king in 483 BC when he was about 32 years old, in 485 BC. And that was the first full year of his reign. So he became king in 486, but the first full year of his reign was in 45. And then this elaborate banquet that he had for his officials and nobles, apparently the purpose of that banquet was that it was the military planning for his expedition that he was going to make against Greece. Well, that expedition historically didn't turn out very well. It didn't turn out like they planned. And once again, you go with the, remember now the decisions that they made while they were, it wasn't a very good decision, right? So finally, the king returned to Persia, and that's when his advisor said, you know, what you really need is a new queen. So he was kind of down in the dumps because the expedition had not gone well. So that's when Esther was chosen to be the new queen. And of course, once again, God is working behind the scenes to bring about his purposes, even though he had to do it in a very unusual, unexpected way of the evil Haman threatening to destroy the people. But that was turned around all one night when the king couldn't sleep. And remember that when from the Book of Esther, that this was a long, drawn-out process. You didn't just become queen overnight. So you remember that Esther was brought to Susa for 12 months of preparation before she could even have a chance to be the queen. And so that's when Xerxes returned to Susa, or Shushan, to have the opportunity to have a new queen. So that is part of the reason that scholars think that Xerxes was this King Ahasuerus or Achashverosh. Because the events of the Book of Esther seem to fit in better with his story. One of the things about the Book of Esther that I think is important is that the king was not able to rescind his decree. His decree that allowed the people to kill the Jewish people and steal their property, that was irrevocable. It couldn't be rescinded. So what the king did under the guidance of Mordecai was to issue a second decree, which allowed the Jewish people to defend themselves. And as is often the case, when criminals or terrorists or bullies find that the person that they plan to attack can fight back, it doesn't seem like such a good idea. And that was what happened with the story of Esther, was the the Jewish people were not destroyed because they were able to defend themselves, and most of the people who were hoping to get great gain from killing them and taking their property decided not to do it at all. And as we learned last week in the sermon, there is no contradiction between being a follower of God and vigorously defending yourself against assault. So we prefer to give people the gospel, but if they don't want to hear the gospel and they want to attack us instead, we're ready for them. Are there any questions or comments about? There's Brian has one.
The Jewish holiday Purim, I remember when I was young and going to Hebrew school, that when we as Christians have our young people do skits or plays on Easter or Christmas, that Purim was a popular holiday for the children to put on skits of Purim.
Yeah.
And young people in the Jewish faith get real excited for the holiday of Purim. And one reason is it's because they have the sweets of the Hamantaschen, which is the cookie of Haman. And they're usually a poppy seed or a apricot filling in a triangular type shaped cookie.
The reason that they are triangular shaped is because they say that Haman wore a triangular shaped hat.
Yeah, yeah. So they thought it was, then you get to feast on Haman.
Yeah. Well, the word Hamantaschen is a Yiddish word, and it actually means Haman's ears. So the cookies are called Haman's ears. Brian. Another Brian.
Yeah.
We went from Brian to Brian.
Okay. Do I have this right that, okay, so I understand that Ahasuerus is Xerxes, but is Xerxes Cyrus? No.
No. Cyrus was an earlier Persian king.
Was earlier?
Yes.
Oh, right. You're right. He's
the one who first allowed the Jewish people to go back to Jerusalem.
Right. Okay. 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 So then my other question is, and I don't mean to be cynical about this, because I do believe, of course, that the Lord moved Cyrus to decree that people would go back and build the temple. But is there any information about the motives that he would have had to do that? Because if he just conquered, and maybe I've got the timeline a little confused yet, but Cyrus had conquered Babylon and shortly after that made the decree, why would he want all the people he just conquered to leave what he just conquered?
Well, the reason for that is that there's a big difference between the Babylonian Empire and the Persian Empire. Different policies. The Babylonians wanted to deport peoples and move them somewhere else and then move another group of people into that. The Persians came along and they wanted to reverse that policy. They didn't want to do that. They wanted to allow people to go back to their homeland and to restore their places of worship. Not just the Jews, but everybody.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
So it has to do with the different policies. See, you've heard of the of Machiavelli, the book back from the Renaissance, whenever that was. Different empires, different conquerors have had different philosophies about what to do with their peoples, you know. So some rulers are more, I want them to be afraid of me. And so that was part of the mindset of the Babylonians, was to move people around and shuffle them around and keep them in terror. Whereas other rulers recognize that the easiest way for me to rule my empire is to keep people happy, to keep people content. So that's a different mindset between the Babylonians and the Persians. That's why the kings of Persia were more wanting people to go back to their homeland. And it's interesting that a lot of Jews didn't go back to their homeland. A lot of them stayed in Babylon or in Susa or wherever they lived, because you know how it is. You put down roots and you get used to living there. That's why we have the Babylonian Talmud. There were still lots of Jews living in Babylon.
I just wanted to say I appreciate you putting this into the perspective of the history of, you know, the timelines. And I think because sometimes we want to look at a story like this and we put it in a wall block. And if we even go back further, Haman was actually a descendant of Agag, which was part of the Amalekites, which Saul was supposed to have destroyed but didn't. And so when Samuel came to confront him on that, that's when Saul grabbed his robe, and the robe tore, and the two kingdoms divided. So, I mean, there's a whole lot that drags forward that kind of puts it all into perspective, and the consequences of not obeying.
The whole thing about Agag and Haman being an Agagite, or whatever you want to call it, that's... is a complicated thing, because some people think that Haman was descended from Agag, and other people don't. Because all the people of Agag were killed, and then Saul spared Agag, but when Samuel arrived, he killed him. So there's a question of, well, if all of the Agagites, the people ruled by Agag, were killed, how did Haman survive? I mean, how did his ancestors survive? So if you've ever seen the movie version of the story of Esther called A Night with the King, or I think that's what it's called, One Night with the King, or A Night with the King, or whatever. But in that story, they speculate that Agag's wife was not killed, and she was pregnant at the time, so that's how this line that ended up in Haman. That's speculation. The Bible doesn't say that. One of the commentaries that I read about the book of Esther said that Haman wasn't descended from Agag at all, that there were people in the Persian Empire who were Agagites, so they were a different people that had that name, so... What is the correct answer? I don't know.
Thank you so much, Dana. We're impressed with your help.
In 2 weeks, I was going to do a study on Acts chapter 7. This is where Stephen is giving his sermon, his speech, before he's stoned. The reason I like that particular chapter of Acts so much from an apologetic standpoint, because it gives us an opportunity to explain, to give some examples of how critics of the Bible say, well, there's a conflict between what Stephen says and what the Old Testament says, and it shows how we can explain those alleged discrepancies. That's why I like it so much.
So that'll be in 2 weeks on the 11th.
Yes.
On
the 11th of March. So be there for that. Well, let's close with a word of prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you so much that you are involved in our lives, and you're involved in the history of the world. You're involved in current events, and you're always moving things in the direction that you plan, and that man is unable to thwart your plans, to disrupt your plans, that everything works out as you direct. We thank you for that. We thank you for the assurance that you give us through your promises, and the assurance that you will always be with us and you will keep those promises. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you.